Although the decisions of grand juries have been dominating the news recently, for most people, the reasons we have them and how they work remain unclear. So we have decided to make them, and juries in general, the topic of this week's Please Explain. Joining me now are Lauren Brooke Eisen, counsel in the Brennan Center's Justice Program, and Bennett L. Gershman, a former prosecutor and professor at Pace University School of Law. Welcome to our show.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you.
And we invite you, our listeners, to join in the conversation. You can give us a call at 212-433-9692 or write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Bennett, how and when did the grand jury system start?
The grand jury originated in England about 800 years ago when King Henry convened what we call then a grand assize, composed of local gentry, to investigate for the king and enforce his laws against the church and feudal barons. That's the first time we see the actions of this grand jury.
But then, obviously, it must have become popular because it continued as part of common English law, didn't it?
Well, it continued, next time we note the function of the actual grand jury, the kind of grand jury we see today, was about 500 years later. And at that time, the grand jury asserted its role not just as an accuser of the guilty, but as a protector of the innocent. And that dual role has been carried through all the way to our Constitution. And in our Fifth Amendment, there's a requirement that a grand jury be used to charge people with crimes.
So
that,
we were borrowing
it.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
That requirement has not been found to be applicable to the states. So New York does not have to use a grand jury, and actually only 18 states do use the grand jury as a mechanism for charging persons with crimes.
Did the American colonies just borrow the British system, or did we Americanize it?
No, I think we borrowed it pretty much in the same way. I mean, the 23 grand jurors, which is basically what Blackstone said the early English grand jury was composed of, and you need 12 jurors to vote an indictment. That pretty much is the model that we took from England, and that's pretty much the model today.
Lauren Brooke, trial juries also originated in England.
Yes, and trial juries differ from grand juries because the purpose of a grand juror, as the professor said, really is to decide whether someone should be charged with a crime, whether there is probable cause. So the bar is very low. A jury, however, is a very different system. Juries are, in New York at least, in New York criminal court, criminal jurors consist of 6 individuals. And for felony trials, so in the New York Supreme Court, the juries consist of 12 jurors and 3 or 4 alternates. And the mission of the jury is very different from the grand jury because the jury is deciding whether someone will be convicted of a crime, whether there is a reasonable and the bar there, the standard is beyond a reasonable doubt.
But they all seem to vary according to state or region.
They do. So the jury process really is, found in the state statutes. So all of the states do differ in terms of how many people are on their juries.
A concept that we often hear about is a jury of one's peers. Does that suggest that the jury should be made up of people who reflect racial and ethnic backgrounds of the community?
Well, that is something that really goes to the heart of the jury system and some of the controversy that has been swirling around the jury system for years. You know, originally, communities were much smaller, and jurors did reflect a community of peers. But as we've seen, New York City is a perfect example. We have 5 boroughs, and we have lots of racial diversity in the boroughs. And, sometimes the jury does reflect a jury of one's peers, and sometimes it doesn't. So that is something that, you know, prosecutors and defense attorneys do always try to work at when they're selecting their jurors.
But we often like to talk about our founding fathers. Bennett, weren't juries restricted to white landowners during the colonial era and into the early years of the United States?
Yes, that's correct. In fact, up until 30 or so years ago, African Americans were almost always excluded from juries by prosecutors, and there was very little way of prosecutors being held accountable for that. The test was so difficult to charge a prosecutor with discrimination that this was the case for, as I say, until fairly recently.
And prosecutors were excusing them because they said that they would have a bias?
Well, they didn't say that. But
doesn't a judge have to sometimes? Can't a judge sometimes say, "Well, you can't just excuse every black person who comes into this jury room"?
Not until the Supreme Court, in a landmark case of Batson against Kentucky, said that the judge could make the prosecutor explain the reason for his strikes. But up until then, lawyers and prosecutors in particular could strike jurors without giving any reason. That's one of the attributes of, you know, the jury selection system, the voir dire, up until this landmark case, as I say, about 25 or 30 years ago, where now the prosecutor has to explain why he's striking a particular juror, whether it's African-American, whether it's a woman, or any you know, minority group like this. The prosecutor can be asked to explain the reason, and that's something that never happened before.
So did we start seeing a lot more African Americans in juries as a result?
Yes.
What about women?
Well, the rule applies to women also. I mean, women were exempted from jury service for quite a while. I mean, it was always all male juries up until about, you know, again, fairly recently, 25, 30 years ago, where women, the exclusion of women was found unconstitutional, and now women certainly serve on juries, I think, as often as men do. And if there is an attempt to discriminate against, let's say, women on a jury, again, the prosecutor has to be held accountable for that and can be asked to explain why he's doing that.
My guests are Bennett L. Gershman, a professor of law at Pace University School of Law, and Lauren Brooke Eisen, counsel in the Brennan Center's Justice Program. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and today's Please Explain is looking at juries and grand juries. And Lauren Brooke, what determines whether a prosecutor elects to bring a case before a grand jury? Because an awful lot of cases aren't brought before them.
Well, if a prosecutor is seeking a felony indictment in a case, at least in New York State, it is common to use the grand jury process, and in New York, that is the most common way that a prosecutor would seek to secure an indictment in a felony case.
But there are an awful lot of cases that we hear of where somebody's arrested, spent some time in Rikers, and then they're brought before a judge, and they're either found guilty or not guilty, or more often than not, actually have some kind of a plea bargaining arrangement, and there's no grand jury involved.
Well, in misdemeanor cases, you would not utilize the grand jury process. And additionally, you can plea before if you waive your right to a grand jury hearing, and that's called a Supreme Court information.
So anything like a murder trial would automatically have been the result of a grand jury first?
In New York State, yes, the grand jury would almost always be used in a situation like that.
Can people waive the right to a grand jury?
Yes, a defendant has the right to waive a grand jury hearing. And also in New York State, per statute, so, you know, by New York State law, defendants have a right to testify in the grand jury itself, which is not the case in every state.
Bennett, are there grand juries in federal cases?
The grand jury is required in federal criminal cases. The Fifth Amendment to the Constitution requires that for a felony charge against someone, the grand jury must be employed.
Why are grand jury proceedings kept secret? Is that true in federal and in every state instance?
Yes. The principle of grand jury secrecy is fundamental. It's there to protect the grand jurors. It's there to protect witnesses. It's there to prevent defendants from escaping when they learn there is some kind of an investigation against them. I mean, there are very weighty reasons why this rule of secrecy is so ingrained and so important. And that's, you know, that's one of the key features of the grand jury. I mean, I think people should know that. I mean, the grand jury is an accusatory body. It's secret. There's no judge. There's no lawyer for witnesses. The prosecutor is there, and the prosecutor runs the show. It's the prosecutor and the grand jury. And I think people should understand that you know, the grand jury is, in effect, an adjunct of the prosecutor. They work with the prosecutor. They do what the prosecutor wants them to do. This is not an independent body that just roams all over the place looking at evidence. I mean, the prosecutor decides what evidence is presented. The prosecutor will determine what charges to bring. The prosecutor is the legal advisor to the grand jury. The prosecutor instructs the grand jury on the law. And pretty much the prosecutor will dictate what to charge, who to give immunity to. It's the prosecutor's show. And I think, you know... And what's more important, I think, is that the prosecutor can insulate himself from public criticism by saying that it was the grand jury that did this, this, and this. And I think that's really misleading. And
you're a former prosecutor.
Yeah, I'm a former prosecutor, and I can vouch for that. That is the way it works.
And so you would agree with the famous quote of Saul Wackler, the former chief judge of New York State, that if a prosecutor wants it, a grand jury would indict a ham sandwich.
It's a great metaphor, but basically it illustrates the point. The prosecutor can get the grand jury to do what the prosecutor wants the grand jury to do.
So I take take a slight exception to that. There actually is some statistical evidence coming out of Kings County in Brooklyn that I think it was about 10% or so of indictments presented to the grand jury actually resulted in no bills, dismissals, and you know. The grand jury, while...
But 10% is a very small percentage. That's 90% are leading to indictments.
Right, but the professor was saying that it's really the prosecutor's tool. And the grand jury is an arm of the court. It's not an arm of the prosecutor's office. Yes, the prosecutor can pick and choose, you know, what evidence the grand jury hears, but it really is not... You know, it is officially an arm of the court. And so I just think that's something that's important to understand in
this
conversation.
Can I just jump in? Because I would say that those dismissals are very likely dismissals that the prosecutor sought or didn't really care about. Because don't forget, if the grand jury indicts, the prosecutor has to try the case. And perhaps the prosecutor didn't want to try those cases but wanted the grand jury to vote no bill rather than be saddled with a case that the prosecutor felt was untriable.
Sometimes there are leaks from the grand juries. We saw that in Ferguson. Are the leakers ever punished?
Very rarely. Very rarely. It's very hard to prove how the leak happened because there are so many possibilities. And I don't know of that many investigations really into grand jury leaks. I know that there might be leaks of, you know, in terms of reporters leaking information, but I really can't think of cases where grand jury leaks have been prosecuted. I can't think of any recent cases along those lines.
Lauren Brooke, how are the jurors selected for a grand jury?
So the jurors for a grand jury are selected in New York State, at least, by those who are registered to vote or from the DMV records. So if you have a driver's license or you're registered to vote. And in New York, the grand jury is 23 people. I know in Missouri, it was, I think, 11 or 12 people. The jury process is a little bit different. So the regular jury process is a little bit more involved, and the prosecutor and the defense attorney, what they do is they conduct something that's called voir dire, and they, you know, really comb through the jurors and ask questions with the judge in the room.
So there's no voir dire in the grand jury system.
There's not the same equivalent in the grand jury system. No.
Well, how does the prosecutor know that this isn't a person who would have very strong biases, perhaps against the prosecutor's attempts to get somebody indicted?
There is some questioning that goes on. It's just not that same extensive process. And there's a reason for that, because the jury process, the regular jury is deciding whether someone is innocent or guilty of a crime. And, you know, that's just considered much more serious than deciding whether there's probable cause to bring charges against someone in the first place.
Now, a grand jury sits for a fair amount of time. So that would mean that not everybody would even be available.
Well, the way that the grand jury process traditionally works is that it may sit for a month, but one day a month or 2 days a month. And again, it depends, you know, on the jurisdiction. It even varies in New York City from borough to borough. But usually if you're impaneled for a month, you would not sit for, you know, 5 days a week.
Bennett, how often are police indicted in grand jury trials? So we're talking about that 10%. Is the percentage different when we're talking about police?
From my experience, indictments of police for using excessive force is not frequent. In fact, in New York State, I think it's very, very infrequent. Up here in Westchester, where I teach, there were three very serious killings of civilians by the police. None of those cases resulted in indictments, even though I have to say the cases were fairly strong and was certainly triable. It's not often that that police officers are indicted for, let's say, using lethal force that's been one of the big questions that people have been talking about recently. Why so few indictments against police for their use of excessive force that has resulted in death?
Is it different?
The reasons to me are pretty straightforward. These are the reasons people have been talking about. It's a relationship between the prosecutor and the police. It's difficult for the prosecutor to work with the police today and then tomorrow be prosecuting the police. And I think many people in the public and on juries, look to the police as their guardians, their protectors. It's one thing to charge police with corruption. And in those kinds of cases, I see many more indictments of police for the kind of misconduct, stealing drugs, lying, taking bribes. But when it comes to using excessive force, I think the public typically, at least on the juries that I've seen, trust the police officer's judgment. Because here we're talking about judgment. We're not talking about honesty. And I think many people feel the police are their protectors. They're protectors of their property, their lives. And so they give a lot of deference to the police, and they give the police the benefit of the doubt. And I think that's what happened in Staten Island.
Do you agree, Lauren, Brooke?
Well, I think it's hard to know what happened in Staten Island. The evidence is sealed, and so all of this is just mere conjecture.
But I'm talking about the public's perception. For example, in today's Times, there was a piece about the possible planting of guns on people the cops arrested simply because they want to make their quotas. We see a lot of articles like that. We've been hearing a lot about people who've been exonerated in Brooklyn and elsewhere because possible police, what word do I want to use there? But I would think that would make the public a little more wary of trusting the police than they would have 20 or 30 years ago.
Well, I would absolutely agree. And I work at the Brennan Center, and a lot of what we work on is changing the incentives in terms of, what the police are rewarded for, how they receive, merit bonuses, how they move, up within the police force, looking at federal grants and criminal justice dollars and how those might incentivize low-level arrests instead of focusing on more serious violent crimes. So, I think the police, unfortunately, are sometimes incentivized to make low-level arrests. And there is some mistrust right now, for obvious reasons, between the police and, communities of color and urban communities. And, that the president has created this 21st century task force on policing. And we'll see where that task force goes and what sort of recommendations the task force comes up with. But at the Brennan Center, we're hopeful that the task force will look at criminal justice grants, We'll also look at improved training techniques for police, such as training police on implicit bias, use of force, increasing diversity within police forces to really reflect the communities that they're policing, and, you know, hopefully focus more on community policing, where police officers are getting out of their cars, walking the beat, learning people's names in the communities that they're policing. And, you know, we really are hoping that there will be a shift in how the police and the communities work together in the future.
My guests are Lauren Brooke Eisen, who's a counsel in the Brennan Center's Justice Program, and Bennett L. Gershman, who's a former prosecutor, professor at Pace University School of Law. And we'll be taking your calls and looking further into the grand jury and jury systems after we take a little break. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write to us online at WNYC.org on our show page, or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And we are back with Please Explain and Bennett L. Gershman, former prosecutor, professor at Pace University School of Law, and Lauren Brooke Eisen, counsel in the Brennan Center's Justice Program. We're talking about grand juries and juries in general, and taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WMIC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And our first call is from Pablo from Staten Island. Hi, Pablo.
Hey, Leonard. How are you doing?
Okay. What's your question?
So I guess if I'm hearing it correct, that the prosecutor can basically manipulate the grand jury to go his way. And since in Staten Island, they work closely with the police force, is that what happened over there? Because if so, then there was no chance in hell that they were going to indict the police officer.
Bennett, isn't that kind of what you were saying?
That's what I was saying. I think the relationship between the prosecutor and the police is so close that it makes it very difficult for the prosecutor to see these cases impartially, objectively, neutrally, and decide whether or not the evidence is sufficient to charge a crime. Clearly, in my opinion, the evidence in Mr. Garner's case was clearly legally sufficient, and there was probable cause to believe that the killing was unjustified. Now, you know, I am speculating as to what happened inside the grand jury. I don't know exactly what the prosecutor told the jurors. I think we do know, though, that the prosecutor handled the testimony of Mr. Penaleo, the officer, I believe, with kid gloves. I don't think they really challenged him. He was there in the grand jury. He had his lawyer there, and he basically gave a story that might, as I see it, according to what his lawyer said he testified to, in ways that were seriously contradicted by the video. But I don't know that he was challenged on any of that. And the question is why.
When you were a prosecutor, did similar cases come your way?
Absolutely.
What happened?
Well, I mean, if it was a police officer who tried to, was there, he waived immunity, which you have to do in the grand jury in New York or else you get immunity. He waived immunity and he wanted to testify, which isn't that often, by the way. I mean, usually persons charged with crimes or targets of the grand jury investigation, rarely do they want to step inside the grand jury because they know they're fair game for the prosecutor's challenges and interrogation and impeachment and so on. So it's rare that a person who might be a target of a crime will even step into the grand jury and be questioned excessively and probed closely by the prosecutor. But I don't think the prosecutor laid a hand on Mr. I don't think he did anything to challenge Mr. Penaleo's story.
Okay.
And then the result is clear.
Lernbrook, how often do grand jury indictments lead to later convictions? Is it usually the case that if somebody is indicted by a grand jury, that they'll be found guilty on trial?
Well, in grand juries, you only need 12 people of the 23, at least in New York State, to bring forth an indictment.
It's a basic majority.
However, for a jury trial, it needs to be unanimous. So in a felony case, you would need all 12 jurors to agree. And if there's just one juror who disagrees, then you're not going to receive a conviction in that case.
Mm. It's a hung jury.
Yes.
Let's take another call. Larry from Park Slope, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Well, I think the discussion is rather astute. There's one thing historically in New York, for example, and in some other jurisdictions, is the phenomenon of the runaway grand jury. And that's how Thomas E. Dewey was named a special prosecutor in the 1930s, where the grand jurors literally threw the assistant DA out of the courtroom. Now, it doesn't happen a lot, but I think part of the problem is the judicial administration in explaining to the grand juries just how broad their powers are, the power to ask questions, the power to disregard the prosecutor. And that's a reform that could take place within the existing law without even the appointment of a special prosecutor.
How often do we see runaway grand jurors?
Not often, but the problem is the courts don't give the grand jurors the information. The impaneling judge does not give the court, the grand jurors rather, the information on the extent of their powers independent of the prosecutor.
Let me throw this open to my guests. What do you think are the circumstances that will lead to a runaway grand jury? Is it that the members of the jury just see the prosecutor as being too biased in a case? Bennett?
I think that's a possibility. I think that if the jury sees the prosecutor engaging in excessive character assassination of certain witnesses, if they see the prosecutor overreaching and treating witnesses abusively, I mean, if they see that happen, it may be that some of the grand jurors suddenly start to feel that this is an unfair process. And that might trigger some of these jurors to ask questions, to wonder what's going on. But again, you know, the runaway grand jury is very, very rare. Mm-hmm. And typically the psychology inside the grand jury is that the jurors work with the prosecutor. There's almost a bond between the jurors and the prosecutor. That's the typical case, in my opinion. So that it's going to be extraordinarily rare for a jury to diverge from what they feel the prosecutor wants the jury to do.
Although I've been on a regular jury where other members of the jury just felt the judge was too biased in the case, and it played a role in the final decision.
Well, there's something in jury trials. There's a term called jury nullification. And although it's very rare, you do see it in cases of statutory rape where the defendant may be 18 and the victim 16, and the jury just feels that, and the couple were dating, and the jury feels that that shouldn't be a crime. And we saw that a lot, actually, in the past, with prohibition and with some of the fugitive slave laws, that juries, they do have the right to just disagree with the law. And if one juror of the 12 feels that, this should not be a crime, we're seeing that sometimes with low-level drug possession, that there are people who just feel strongly that possession of marijuana, possession of, small amounts of cocaine should not be a crime. And if that one person decides that, they will not convict, even though the prosecutor has proved the case beyond a reasonable doubt, that will result in jury nullification.
Let's take another call. This is from Rex from Manhattan. Hi, Rex. You're on the air.
It's Rick.
Okay.
I was just on a grand jury, Leonard, and it was the most horrifying experience in my life. It was a total travesty of justice. I saw people being just corralled and sent away with felony charges. The prosecutors misled us repeatedly to advance their careers. And my grand jury didn't know that 97% of these cases end up in plea bargains and that these defendants never get an opportunity to air their case. And that a lot of these people feel that they were unfairly charged. And I just wanted to add that I'm so glad you're putting this on the air, because I think we have a serious problem in our judicial system. From now on, I'm calling it the criminal injustice system, what I saw. Constant entrapment by police. All the defendants were black, low-level drug offenses. My fellow grand jurors, we had this discussion. Everybody had taken drugs. But if you're black and you take drugs, you better hide it. If you're white, nothing will happen to you.
Now, a number of people
recommend.
Go ahead, Ben.
Because what Rick said is an important point here. the grand jury presentation by the prosecutor is totally one-sided. There is no requirement that the prosecutor tell the grand jury about evidence that might be exonerating, that might be in favor of the person they're charging. The prosecutor doesn't have to do that, and that might be some kind of a reform that, you know, we might want to think about. The prosecutor has to do it in a regular jury trial, and if he doesn't, it violates the Constitution. But in a grand jury setting, the prosecutor does not have to do that, and I think that's a point that should be made.
Now, it's some totally people have suggested getting rid of the grand jury system altogether. You're suggesting that a better solution might be to reform it?
No, I think that getting rid of the grand jury is certainly maybe where we see the future. I mean, have the prosecutor charge the defendant by information and then give the defendant an opportunity to have a preliminary hearing before a judge. Prosecutor puts witnesses on the stand. They do that in some jurisdictions, and that might be a better way to go because the grand jury system is really a fiction.
That's the way they do it on The Good Wife anyway, but that's because it's supposed to take place in Illinois. What about you, Lauren Brooke? Do you think we might get rid of the grand jury system?
Well, I think the grand jury system has its place. I mean, as the professor mentioned at the beginning of the show, it is used as a sword and a shield, and I think it really is important to protect the innocent against unfounded accusations. I mean, that's the heart of the grand jury system, and that's why you have grand jury secrecy. However, a lot of states, they also use preliminary hearings where they present evidence to a judge. Some states, such as Hawaii, it's ingrained in their state constitution, they require independent counsel be present in the grand jury proceedings. So there are a lot of ways to indict someone on felony charges. And I think at the very least, what we'll see after, all of these conversations really will probably go forward. And I think we will see some changes in how grand juries are used and alternatives to grand juries. So it'll be interesting to watch.
Well, since we're talking about a jury of our peers, I kind of brought this up earlier. We have very little time, but the people who are most likely to be able to devote time to continually sitting on a jury are retirees, are people who aren't necessarily peers of the person who's being tried there. So isn't the whole thing rather skewed anyway?
Well, in terms of the grand jury, you do sometimes have to devote more time than you would just to a regular jury trial that might only be a couple of days. But regular jury trials can also last a month, depending on the seriousness of the case. And you can only put off your jury duty or your grand jury duty for so many years in New York State.
My guests have been Lauren Brooke Eisen, who's a counsel in the Brennan Center's Justice Program, and Bennett L. Gershman, a former prosecutor and a professor at Pace University's School of Law. And I thank you both so much for being on our show today for this look at juries, mostly grand juries, but we've pretty much tried to do a whole thing about the judicial system. And I've learned a lot. Thank you both so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.